literally, and I suspect it's true on this particular webinar, where those who are participating, both as event contributors like myself, but also folks who are listening to it and watching it, and then will be asking questions. I tend to be the least knowledgeable of all the people in such enterprises, and I don't suspect that's going to be different today. What should scare you is that when I did serve in the legislature, I was what passed for someone as a legislator who had a lot of knowledge about this subject matter. So what it shows is that legislature is good for some things, and when it comes to ocean conservation, we have to really work hard at it to do it right. As many of you may know, in California, what has happened over the history of our state is that the Fish and Game, now called the Fish and Wildlife Department and Commission, were some of the very first parts of state government. And in fact, the Fish and Game Commission is enshrined in the state constitution. And when the state was first in the union and the Department of Fish and Game and the commission were established, their mission was really rather different than it is now. And the reason for that is that we were rural, sparsely populated, basically an agricultural economy. And even in the few years after the gold rush, we were still that way. And so the challenge in the environment in terms of managing public trust resources was really to look at it from a point of view that we had an enormous amount of abundance. We had an abundance of redwoods. We had an abundance of grazing land. We had an abundance of rivers and streams and creeks with anadromous fisheries. We had an abundance of fisheries in the nearshore coastal waters. And as time went on, and we had an abundance, the abundance was also part of the ethic of the country. And the abundance was viewed as something to be, in essence, either mined or fished or logged or whatever to meet the needs of an expanding state and an expanding population. Certainly that was true in the became very focused and very aware, not only right after the discovery of gold, but more importantly, after the 1906 earthquake, when there was a big demand for timber and cement and all kinds of other building materials. And so there was an awful lot of pretty serious clear cutting of redwoods in the redwood belt that runs from basically Monterey County up into Humboldt and Mendocino. There was a lot of the population was increasing, so the fisheries were being fished pretty substantially. But even so, from a public policy perspective, the issue was, how do you manage abundance? And the response to that, given the state of science and the state of understanding of the issues, is you don't manage much at all. That basically Fish and Game existed in large part to collect hunting license and fishing license fees, and to do a relatively small amount of actual what we would characterize today as management. Well, by the time you get to the end of the last century, in the late 1990s, we've got a state that is then moving itself from being rural, sparsely populated, basically agricultural. We've now got 150 years of experience as a state, and as you all know, we're then the most populous state in the nation, a tremendously active economy. 70% of the 38 million people live within roughly 1 hour's drive of the coast. They place enormous pressures on whether it's the redwood forests or it's the nearshore coastal waters or it's individual fisheries or it's the anadromous fisheries or whatever it might be. But within the Department of Fish and Game, now called Fish and Wildlife, the world changes on them. And in the late 1990s, the thought occurred to a number of people, maybe what we should do is take a serious look at the underlying foundational tools that we have, because we've moved from a place where we are managing abundance to a place where we are managing scarcity. And because of that, it literally is not possible to be successful with managing scarcity by using tools that were designed in an environment when we were managing abundance. Hence, the authoring of the Marine Life Management Act, followed a year and a half later by the Marine Life Protection Act. And it was in the Marine Life Protection Act that some of the tools we're going to discuss today, or that you're going to discuss today, come into existence. There were marine protected areas and other tools available prior to the Marine Life Management Act and Marine Life Protection Act, but they were used rather indifferently, or, and I don't use this word typically as a pejorative term, used politically. And what I mean is establishing a marine protected area here, there, or somewhere else without a real comprehensive look at what that using that management tool might mean, nor was there any real enforcement or systematic way of dealing with the thought of a particular marine protected area in a particular place designed to do a particular thing. There wasn't what you would characterize, I think, as systematic integration of management, but instead a thought that, gee, maybe by designating an area on the ocean, something good will happen. And by the time you get into the late 1990s, it's time to refresh both the underlying law, how to manage in scarcity, and how to modernize the tool of marine protected areas. And so beginning with the Marine Life Management Act and then moving to the Marine Life Protection Act, what the state did was said, we are going to be absolutely crystal clear of what we are managing towards in the marine environment. And so in the Marine Life Protection Act, the Marine Life Management Act, you find in the first sentence that it says the objective of this act is to be able to manage the state waters so that they are sustainable for the life therein. And that gives rise then to a very system integrated approach to managing the coastal waters. Specifically then, when the Marine Life Protection Act comes along, the idea is to have science-based, science-monitored, iterative use of the marine protected areas. Many of you know there were a couple of false starts on that, but after a couple of false starts, we had a real good start that ended up with a chain of marine protected areas from the Oregon border with California to the Mexican border with California, and a very robust monitoring enterprise run through the California Ocean Science Trust, paren disclosure. I'm a trustee of that, so you have to consider the source. But the Marine Life Protection Act's marine protected areas are intended to be fine tools rather than more brute tools for ocean management, so that the size and shape and duration and conditions of each one are based on good, sound, and iterative and evolving science and the information that comes out of the monitoring enterprise, as well as citizen science and a number of other things that go on. And the thought is that by managing our marine environment, not exclusively with that, but with the marine protected areas being a modernized, new, science-based, and ever-changing tool, that we will do better at managing towards sustainability. So thank you so much for including me in this and for your interest. My guess is the people on this call, again, are vastly more knowledgeable than I am, but I did want to give you a perspective from the legislative point of view about how did we get here, why were we trying to do it. And we were trying to do it because we had moved from abundance to scarcity, and we had moved from having little science and little effectiveness in managing in the marine environment to a lot of very good science along the California coast and the ability to monitor and iterate that. So thank you very much, Ricky.
Thank you so much, Fred, and thank you for taking us through 150 years of conservation history in 10 minutes, Fred. That was an excellent summary. Now to hear more about how California moved basically from the 1990s from reacting to crisis to proactive management, I'm going to hand it over to longtime conservation leader and advocate Caitlin Gaffney. Caitlin worked tirelessly for the Ocean Conservancy, helping to design California's network of underwater parks, and is currently working for the Resources Legacy Fund as Director of Coasts and Oceans. Caitlin?
Thank you. Thank you, Ricky, and thank you to Fred for providing that historical context. You know, as everyone on the call knows, California has a long history of leadership in protecting special ocean places on land. As Ricky just mentioned, it was over 150 years ago that President Abraham Lincoln originally ceded Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Sequoia Grove to the state of California, setting aside those places for inspiration, public use, and preservation. And that was the first land that Congress had ever set aside for those purposes. Since that time, California has done a tremendous job protecting areas on land. We have 26 national park units in the state and 280 state parks. But it wasn't until the 1990s that we took that same philosophy of conservation and really applied it holistically to the ocean environment. So it was in 1999 that the California legislature adopted the Marine Life Protection Act. And for the first time, the law in California required a proactive approach to ocean conservation as opposed to simply responding to crisis. Under the Marine Life Protection Act, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the California Fish and Game Commission were tasked with engaging scientific experts and coastal citizens to help design a system of underwater parks or protected areas with the goal of conserving ocean habitats and wildlife statewide while also enhancing recreation, education, and research, again, much as our state parks do on land. So just as our state and national parks protect special areas on land, the Marine Life Protection Act called for creation of these protected areas in the ocean. As this image shows, the maps show the designated areas around the Monterey Peninsula and then in Carmel Bay and at Point Lobos. And what you see here is that there are essentially different flavors of protection in the Marine Life Protection Act toolbox. So the red areas depicted on these maps are no-take areas. Those are referred to as state marine reserves. And within their boundaries, all of the wildlife is fully protected. No hunting, no fishing, no collecting. But in the blue areas, there are special rules that apply, but some fishing may still be allowed. So in 2012, California completed this effort. And was the first state in the nation to adopt a statewide science-based system of marine protected areas. The new network contains 122 separate marine protected areas and covers 848 square miles of ocean habitat for about 16% of the state's waters. It was no easy task as someone who lived through it and attended many of the hundreds and hundreds of meetings from the Oregon border to the border with Mexico. It took more than a decade, and it took the feedback and input and engagement of literally thousands of citizens from across the state. One thing I want to mention here today is really how innovative what California did under the Marine Life Protection Act was and is in two distinct ways, both in terms of what was accomplished. Again, California is the first state in the nation to adopt a science-based system of marine protected areas. But not just what was accomplished, but also how it was accomplished. Again, as Fred mentioned, the marine protected areas designed in California were designed based on science, not the tools of the past where it was a sort of political, a little bit more political whim. This effort brought together teams of really the best and brightest scientists throughout the state, from universities all around California. And the scientists essentially distilled voluminous scientific data and research about ocean conservation and the species and habitats that we have off the California coast. They distilled that information and turned it into simple rules of thumb that could be applied to the creation of marine protected areas. Things like, how big do the protected areas need to be effective? How close together should they be to function as a network, meaning a system of protected areas where the conservation value of the whole system would be greater than the sum of its individual marine protected area parts. So that was really innovative to have such a strong science basis for the planning effort. But also, a second piece that I think was pretty unusual is that the marine protected area planning effort was really done in an extraordinarily thoughtful, inclusive, and fair way, with extensive opportunities for public input and feedback throughout the effort. The input came not only from experts, but also from ordinary Californians from all walks of life who shared an interest and passion for the ocean. Under the requirements of the law, the final network of protection had to include replicates of all key ocean and coastal habitats in the state. So just as our state national parks include a wide range of habitats, from the high mountain peaks of the Sierras to the low desert areas of Death Valley, as well as forests, grasslands, wetlands, and all sorts of other habitats in between, that same approach was applied to designing the marine protected areas to include the widest possible range of ocean habitats. So the final network of protection includes areas like the one depicted here, the really deepest depths of the Monterey Bay Canyon, fully 2 miles below the surface of the Pacific Ocean at its deepest point, but also the lush kelp forests found off Mendocino, Point Lobos, and La Jolla, kelp forests that support over 1,000 different species of ocean life, from spiny lobsters to rockfish to sea otters. Several of the major estuaries along the California coast are protected in the new marine protected areas, such as the nutrient-rich waters of Humboldt Bay, Elkhorn Slough, Morro Bay, and the Tijuana Estuary. All are critical links in the Pacific Flyway, the annual migration route for at least 1 billion birds. The protected areas also include rocky outcrops on the north coast and the Farallon and Channel Islands. These are areas that support hundreds and thousands of nesting and roosting seabirds. Petrels, cormorants, murres, auklets, even puffins benefit from having their nesting areas protected from human disturbance. Marine protected areas also include some of the sandy beach areas at Piedras Blancas and Año Nuevo. They're famous for their cacophony of mating and pupping elephant seals each year. The marine protected area design effort also took into account a wide range of human uses and needs. Ocean recreational users, sport and commercial fishermen and women, surfers, scuba divers, docents, and teachers, business owners, birders, everyone was at the table discussing the issues and priorities for their particular areas, for their particular uses, and working together to ensure both improved conservation and also continued sustainable use of the ocean. On California's north coast, several of the new marine protected areas were designed with special regulatory provisions to ensure that all traditional, non-commercial, tribal gathering, ceremonial, and stewardship activities would be able to continue. Several tribes are now partnering with scientists and with the state of California to engage in marine protected area monitoring and stewardship activities. Throughout the state, marine protected areas were also designed generally to avoid areas close to port and critical commercial fishing grounds to, again, ensure continued access to local catch. Most of the new marine protected areas were located away from favorite sports fishing areas. So some of the new protected areas prohibit commercial fishing while allowing recreational fishing to continue. And of course, the vast majority of the coast remains open to fishing under existing state regulations. One of the goals of the Marine Life Protection Act is to enhance ocean recreation. And California's new underwater parks offer a wide range of recreational uses, including scuba, diving, snorkeling, kayaking, surfing. Recreational ocean users were some of the strongest advocates for California's marine protected areas during the design process, just as they have been in other areas like the Great Barrier Reef in Australia and Cabo Pulmo in Baja, areas that now have marine protected areas as well, and our favorite tourism destinations for recreational users, something that we are already seeing happen in California as well. Another goal of the Marine Life Protection Act is to promote research and education. Protected areas are great places to conduct field science, but they're also great places to engage youth, such as the fellow seen here doing a monitoring program looking for learning about animals in the sandy beach environment in Southern California. So not only were California's new marine protected areas designed with extensive input from coastal citizens throughout the state, but citizens remain involved in helping to study and steward the new protected areas now that they have been established. We have citizen science programs like the Limpets program that includes school children in monitoring both rocky intertidal areas and sandy beaches. Also, the MPA Watch program that serves as a sort of neighborhood watch for the new marine protected areas. These programs are helping monitor the new protected areas. And of course, throughout the state, volunteer docents throughout our state park system and at Aquaria along the coast are also helping educate visitors about the new marine protected areas. So in conclusion, I just want to emphasize that public support and engagement will be critical to the long-term success of California's new marine protected areas, just as it was to their designation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Caitlin, for giving us the overview of the design of the marine protected areas. And as you can all see, it's sort of designed as this Noah's Ark sampling of the different types of species and habitats that are found throughout the state. So thank you so much, Caitlin. And I think she'll be available for any of the questions at the end. So please don't forget to chat in your questions online during the webinar. So now we have this network of marine protected areas that have been placed now for over a year statewide and over, you know, closing in on 7 years in some locations. And the good news is that these marine protected areas are working, and yes, they are a success as far as the evidence from scientists who are conducting all this monitoring and many of the Citizen Watch programs are showing us. There's excellent evidence from many locations along our coast, particularly in older marine protected areas. And these are places like the Channel Islands in Southern California, in Point Lobos here along the Central Coast. There's compelling evidence that these marine protected areas are working, with lush kelp forests brimming with invertebrates and fishes of all sizes. We know from scientists that recovery takes time, and this is because many of the species are slow to mature and reproduce. For instance, many species of rockfish don't mature and start to produce offspring until, you know, 8, 10, and even greater years. But rockfishes are recovering in some places, particularly in these older marine protected areas. Scientists are looking across species, and the trends are encouraging, with increases in the size and abundance of many species of fish. And often these are species of fish that you would predict would have responses because these are targeted by harvesting. If we're looking at some of the important invertebrate species, and these are species that are actually quicker to reproduce, so you would expect that they would recover more quickly. Things like abalone, owl limpets, and lobsters are increasing in many locations. So all of these changes are working to help replenish impoverished populations, and they suggest that the California network of marine protected areas is on the right track, for success. The older MPAs, like I said, offer a glimpse of a possible future for California's entire network of underwater parks. If we look at places like the Channel Islands, and this has been in place for close to 20 years, the kelp forest is recovering following protection of lobster populations. So if we look at this slide here, before protection, so this is on the right-hand side of the slide, loss of lobsters allowed an explosion of sea urchins, which the lobsters prey on, which in turn the sea urchins actually prey on the kelp forest. And that led actually to a decline in kelp cover, right? Because you have lower populations of lobster, explosion of urchins, leading to a decline due to grazing in the giant kelp. Well, after 20 years of lobster recovery, so look at the left-hand side of your slide, you see that you have an increase in the abundance of lobster populations. Those lobster then prey on the urchins. So now there are fewer urchins, and those fewer urchins are now not preying on the algae and the kelp. So you have the kelp forest is now rebounding in many places within the Channel Islands. So this is an example of one of these ecosystem-wide benefits of protection. And these are actually harder or take a longer time for us to see, but we're starting to see some of these benefits in particular locations throughout the network of marine protected areas. So what's next? Science shows us that the future will only likely be better. These protected areas, one way that you can think about it or communicate it to your partners and to stakeholders is that these are a savings account for our natural capital. And while it may take us a while to get back to conditions like this, this is looking at the Channel Islands in the 1960s, it may take us decades to restore California's historic ocean abundance back to what we saw in some of Fred's slides. But marine protected areas are an important part of improved ocean management, and we do look like we have a bright future ahead of us, thanks to both the state efforts and the federal efforts in places like National Marine Sanctuaries. So what can you do? Many of you ask us that question, what can you do to help? Well, there's many ways, and learning more, like all of you today on the webinar, is an excellent first step. We've created this so that you can help spread the word, so that Californians can be proud of this accomplishment. This is a bright success story, and we're happy to work with you to either give this webinar to your staff, to your colleagues, to your different community groups that you might have, or another kind of presentation on California's marine protected areas. Another way that you can help is encourage others to follow the rules. There's some of these excellent monitoring programs like Reef Check and MPA Watch and Limpets that helps people to first understand the rules. Thirdly is to, you know, sort of spread the word and for yourselves that these are places to enjoy. There's lots of ways that people can get out and enjoy places like marine protected areas and sanctuary. They're designed to actually invite exploration by land or by sea. And finally, you can get involved locally, and the Sanctuary Foundation and other organizations can help to guide you to more information and opportunities for how you can enjoy these special places. And a good first stop, this is kind of a clearinghouse of information, is this CaliforniaMPAs.org website, and we can send you that contact information in subsequent emails as well. So at this time, we do have some time for questions. If we have any questions at this time, please send those in on our chat right now. Take an opportunity to do that. Okay. So we do have one question from one of our viewers that's asking what the difference between the state marine protected areas and the federal National Marine Sanctuaries are. And that's an excellent question, and it's often a confusing question for people to understand. So the first, there's many differences, but I'll go through them sort of one by one. The first is that the state network of marine protected areas, the areas that we showed you today, are a state, meaning the California state. It's a law required by the state, which is the Marine Life Protection Act. It's managed by state agencies, which is the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, whereas the National Marine Sanctuaries, of which there are five on the west coast of the United States, and in California we have Cordell Banks National Marine Sanctuaries, the Gulf of Farallones National Marine Sanctuaries, Monterey Bay, and Channel Islands. Those are federal entities, and those are actually managed by NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. So by design, the state marine protected areas, their jurisdiction falls between 0 and 3 nautical miles. That's state waters, whereas the federal government actually manages beyond, they include 0 to 3 nautical miles, but extend beyond 3 nautical miles out to offshore waters. So, for instance, the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, in many places, it extends inside 0 to the shoreline, but it also extends out to close to 30 miles in many cases. Another difference is sort of the goals. So if you look at the goals of the different sanctuaries, each of the goals are sort of targeting a unique protections. So in the case of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, it was by design looking at benthic protection, in particular looking at protecting the Monterey area from oil drilling, whereas the goals of the Marine Life Protection Act, you know, were broad and had conservation objectives, including balancing, you know, sustainable use with ocean conservation. So unless there's any other questions regarding the difference between National Marine Sanctuaries, again, federal, and the state marine protected areas set up by the MLPA, or Marine Life Protection Act. Are there any other questions? We have a question regarding the status of the proposed Chumash protected area between Monterey and the Channel Islands. I don't actually know the answer to that, and we can research that and get back to you, Christine, with an answer, unless somebody on the line has any additional information. Caitlin, I don't know if you have any response to that.
We will have. I'm not sure what the nature of the question is. I think it may refer actually to a proposal for a new national marine sanctuary in that area. So this may be, you know, back to the question that the difference between sanctuaries and state marine protected areas. My understanding is that there is a public effort to advance a new or perhaps extended national marine sanctuary in that area of coastline that there have been citizens working for, really literally for decades in San Luis Obispo County, seeking National Marine Sanctuary protection for their coast, and that there is a current effort underway that is being advanced by the Chumash tribe in that area, as well as many other citizens in that area. But as far as I know, it's under consideration, but I don't think it has any specific legal status at this point.
Okay, it sounds like we got a response from one of our viewers that Fred Collins of the Northern Chumash Tribal Council will be coming to Cambria in June to give a presentation. So we'll do some research on this topic, and we'll send out a response to the entire group because it may be of interest to others as well. Are there any other questions? No? Okay, well, that concludes our webinar for today. We will be hosting the next in the series on May 29th. That's at 3 p.m. And this one today was a real kind of overview of the Marine Life Protection Act and the network of marine protected areas. On May 29th, we're going to actually delve in deeper to the science in more detail and go through some of those science guidelines and rules of thumb that we were talking about. As we said earlier, there's many ways that you can get involved in or support the implementation of the state's network of marine protected areas, and we'd be happy to guide you to more information if you're interested. We hope that today's webinar was enlightening, and we'll be sending you a follow-up email that has an evaluation of how we can best communicate this information with you and to your staff and colleagues, and perhaps, you know, give this in another format or at a different time and location. So we hope that you all enjoy the rest of your day, and thank you so much for joining us.